Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden wins the U.S. presidential election after securing 284 electoral college votes. Iran's president says those behind the sanctions against Tehran should have learned a lesson, calling on the next U.S. administration to return to its obligations. And the Lebanese president calls on the U.S. to offer documents for imposing sanctions on the leader of Lebanon's biggest Christian political bloc, Gebran Bassik. And welcome from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His electoral vote count now stands at 290, surpassing the 270 needed to win the White House. In a tweet, Biden said he promises to be a president for all Americans. His supporters poured onto the streets in front of the White House to celebrate the win. Trump, however, has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner, and the election is far from over. We're going to cross over to Washington, D.C., and talk to our correspondent, Colin Campbell, standing by. Colin, tell us what's going on.
A lot of people who are leading the win or the predicted win, President-elect Biden, some are calling him now, with Pennsylvania putting him over that threshold of 270 electoral votes. And so now people are wondering, you know, what this means for the future of America and just how the U.S. will adjust to a new reality of who could be and will be and should be president of the United States, according to the latest vote count. Now, we do have a current president who's been very recalcitrant when it comes to issues of leaving the presidency in a peaceable way. And I think that's what is the next speculation, how he handled that. We do know that so far he answered with lots of litigation, filing lawsuits in several different states, refuting election results, and whether or not those are going to be resolved quickly. It's also true that many people are surmising about it. The president has warned that he would take these lawsuits all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But according to the latest vote count, former vice president is now president-elect of the United States. He's already started to build a transition team, as it's the custom for incoming presidents. And I think that this is something that he will be doing over the next several weeks. As far as crafting a speech to talk about his apparent win and a hard-fought struggle trying to get people to mail in their ballots to vote early. And obviously, he was the victor in that process of people mailing in their ballots well before Election Day, making sure that their voices were heard despite a COVID-19 environment when we were encouraged to not and line up in long voter lines where we could be further exposed to COVID-19, but rather mail in our votes where it would be a much safer procedure.
Colin, I think the question of the day that many will ask now is this country that is very, very much divided, as we could see in this closely fought race. How easy will it be, or how difficult will it be, to bring the nation back together after all of this? I think that's going to be the question at hand of the day. What do you think? I mean, I'm sure analysts have been looking at this already. Have you heard specific perspectives about this nation divided and being able to bring it together again?
Well, it's definitely going to be an uphill battle trying to bring together the divided nation. Even the former vice president apparently won the election. If you look at the vote counts, how close it was, it shows that there are a lot of people who voted for the president. And their ideology is in stark contrast to the ideologies of supporters who support the former vice president and who launched them into the presidency. And so what the former vice president has to do now is to have a consistent tone, one that does talk about bringing a divided nation together, one who talks about catering to the new and listening concern of their work.
Okay, Colin, I'm gonna cut this off. Thanks so much for being with us, if possible. Maybe we can reestablish that in a better connection. Iran's president has called for the return of the next U.S. administration to its obligations under international law. Hassan Rouhani says Iranians have well resisted U.S. sanctions and economic terrorism over the past 3 years. Rouhani said those behind the sanctions must have learned a lesson. He said they should have come to know that they have been wrong and this will never get them what they sought. The current U.S. president withdrew his country from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Since then, Donald Trump has imposed sanctions under his so-called maximum pressure campaign to choke Iran's economy. The U.S. also unsuccessfully tried to extend the U.N. arms embargo on Iran, which expired last month. And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Lebanon's president has called on the U.S. to offer evidence and documents for imposing sanctions on prominent Christian politician Gibran Basil, who was also the president's son-in-law. Michel Aoun asked the country's caretaker foreign minister to obtain the data and submit it to Lebanon's judiciary to, quote, take the necessary legal measures. The U.S. has blacklisted the leader of Lebanon's biggest Christian political bloc over alleged corruption and ties to the Lebanese resistance movement. Washington deems Hezbollah a terrorist group, and Hezbollah has condemned the blacklisting as a blatant and gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Basil says that U.S. sanctions will not intimidate him or force him to turning his back on the Lebanese people. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and also out of Beirut, journalist Mohammed Cliff. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's start off with Mariam. And Mariam, will fill us in on the latest and what's going on.
Well, we were expecting that there would be more people who were put on the blacklist, and maybe this is probably the final blow for Trump before defeat in the internal presidential election. But of course, when you look at this accusation, it seems that the Americans don't really have much on their plate. They don't have much evidence. And this is why we can get from the statement of Hezbollah, who denounced, of course, they clearly denounced this this accusation, calling it political. And what they said is that the United States is using as a pretext its own internal laws and the laws that, in order to fight terrorism, to use them against the allies of the resistance and under the pretext of fighting corruption. This is something that many are looking at as being ironic. You have people who were in power in Lebanon since the Civil War, since 1975 until today. They are still in power, and they are the ones who have been clearly corrupt. They have caused this corruption. They are, whether in the parliament or through being ministers or so on. Like, for example, the Falangist Party. You have some of the Druze parties as well. So many of those people who were in power are clearly responsible for the corruption that took place for over 30 years in the country. And still no sanctions have been forced on them, sorts of measures have been taken against them. And now they come for Gibran Basil, who hasn't been in power more than a decade, and saying that he is accused of corruption. This is something that many are finding very ironic, and this is why President Michel Aoun is clearly wants to take legal measures, and we'll see how the foreign minister can get from the on legal issues, what type of documents he can get in order to perhaps respond to this issue. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hezbollah has considered this a clear violation of a country whom they say is not only a sponsor of the terrorism around the world, but also a sponsor of corruption and of corrupt states and dictatorship regimes as well. So Hezbollah was clear on this, in that response. And of course, we're probably going to hear something which is official, but we are in the state of a caretaker cabinet. And this is why I think the president now is the only one who could probably take legal measures.
Okay. Mohammed, your take on this. Why do you think that the U.S. has sanctioned Basile at this point in time, and what is it really about?
Well, my dear friend, there are two factors in this issue. The first issue that concerns the formation of the new government led by Saad al-Hariri. The U.S. has been trying to put obstacles into forming a new government ever since the resignation of the caretaker government right now of Hassan Diab. We have seen this during Mustafa Adib, the previous nominee for heading the government. They have placed several obstacles, internal obstacles, in order to rule out any government formation. Now we have Saad al-Hariri, who has close ties with the Americans, with the French, and with also Arab Gulf states. And this is one of the obstacles that they are putting, since now there is a certain vagueness that, well, Trump basically is losing the presidency, so now the Lebanese politicians are still waiting for the outcome of the U.S. elections in order to know what kind of policies Biden will go by. Will he stay with these sanctions, or will he cancel them? This is one point. The other point is that Basile is being a very close ally and very strategic and important ally to Hezbollah, which is designated by the U.S. as a terrorist group. They have issued certain warnings, indirect warnings for the close allies of Hezbollah, particularly Basile and the Free Patriotic Movement. They have placed also sanctions on two of Hezbollah's allies, with whom are Amal Movement and the Marada Movement as well, two of their former ministers. So this is basically putting more pressure on Hezbollah by targeting its allies in order for its allies to turn their back on Hezbollah and to designate it as a terrorist group. It's part of the whole U.S. Pressure on Lebanese politics and adding more and more complications to the Lebanese political and economic life, which as Lebanese we have been suffering from huge and disastrous economic turmoil and inflation for the past year or so. Thus, as I repeat, that the two main factors in this issue is a pressure on the Lebanese government, especially that they don't want anything that the Americans are trying to place their rules and their conditions on the newly to be formed Lebanese government, that they will not accept any minister that is either indirectly or indirectly related to Hezbollah.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this news review, both out of Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and journalist Mohammed Klett. Turning to Iraq now, where people there have rallied in the capital, Baghdad, to call for the expulsion of American forces from their country. Demonstrators held signs and chanted slogans calling for the implementation of a parliamentary resolution to expel U.S. troops from Iraqi soil. Anti-American sentiment has been high in Iraq following the U.S.'s assassination of Iranian top military general Qasem Soleimani and a senior commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas. In January, the Iraqi parliament voted for a resolution that called for an end to the presence of all foreign forces, including the Americans. Washington, however, continues with its presence in the Arab country under the pretext of fighting the Daesh terror group. And now to the latest with the COVID-19 pandemic. The Coronavirus surges across Europe, with several countries now reporting new record highs in the number of infections and deaths. Austria posted a record high number of more than 8,400 infections. The country also reported nearly 30 deaths. In Poland, the health ministry reported a record number of nearly 28,000 cases, bringing the total number of infections to over 500,000. Hungary registered over 5,300 infection cases and a record high of 107 deaths. The Czech Republic has posted more than 500 coronavirus cases. Now that takes the total number of infections there to more than 403,000. The country also said the death toll rose by nearly 200 to more than 4,300 in total. Meanwhile, protests against the government's handling of the pandemic crisis have continued in Italy. Angry taxi drivers have staged two protests in Rome, calling on authorities to support their sector with subsidies. Max Civilli brings us more from Rome.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. 275 euros each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai 3.600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tire restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civilli, Rome.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world that displaced 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. States shall therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace, development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that wars still cause the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources. Whether high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold and oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be twice as likely to relapse. Concerning this issue, we have prepared an article written by Farhanek Bakhtiari under the heading War Footprint Never Fades Away from Nature. Please stay with us for more of Farhanek Bakhtiari's article. When a war breaks out, one of the first things which comes to mind is casualties and destruction. Whilst one of the main victims of war is the environment, because the effects of war on nature never fade away and can be seen in the food cycle and nature for a long time. War always brings to mind the destruction of houses, deserted villages, smoky cities and streets littered with war weapons and barricades. Massive explosions and ultimately misery, homelessness and death. There are the obvious signs of war, but in the meantime, the part that has been out of sight and out of mind for years is the extent of damage it does to nature, the environment and everything in it, from animals to plants. Perhaps the catastrophe of human-caused war is so great that it is no longer possible to address. Whilst the long-term effects of environmental degradation on the quality of human life are determined and manifested over time. Water wells have been polluted, crops torched, forests cut down, soils poisoned, and animals killed to gain military advantage. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world, and these displaced a total of 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on both people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. Countries shall therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict, and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace, development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that wars still cause the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources. Whether high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold or oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be twice as likely to relapse. The United Nations attaches great importance to ensuring that action on the environment is part of conflict prevention, peacekeeping and peace-building strategies, because there can be no durable peace if the natural resources that sustain livelihood and ecosystems are destroyed. In 2001, the United Nations General Assembly declared 6th of November of each year as International Day for Preventing the Exploitation of the Environment in War and Armed Conflict. Since the devastation of war knows no boundaries, all countries must work together to reduce the destructive effects of war, for example during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, in the process of which Iraq dried up the Hur al-Azim wetland to limit the operation of Iranian fighters in defending their homeland, and now years after the end of that war, the sand and dust storms have taken over Iran, which originates from the dried up parts of Hur al-Azim wetland in neighboring Iraq. Or the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which is another example of this negative impact. During this war, hundreds of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire, polluting vast water and marine resources, as well as polluting the air. Oil and bitumen covered hundreds of kilometers of the coast of the Persian Gulf, which killed at least 30,000 seabirds. When Daesh terrorist group occupied a large part of Iraq and Syria, leaving the agricultural lands abandoned, caused the lands to become sand and dust storm hotspots. However, the negative impact of war are not limited to these measures and effects. Its physical effects still exist, as landmines planted during the Second World War some 70 years ago still claim lives today in Europe, or landmines planted by Iraqis in Western Iranian territories during the war also are taking the lives of hundreds of innocent Iranian civilians. The Deputy Chief of the Department of the Environment, Masoud Tajrishi, told IRNA that one of the biggest challenges posed by conflict and war is population displacement. Putting aside the social impact of the war, the environment is the most important issue that has not received much attention. Tajrishi stated, during the 8 years of Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, we witnessed the displacement of large numbers of people in different parts of the country. He noted also, when the enemy entered Iran, invaded Iranian territory, it planted numerous mines, which made these lands unusable for a long time, even after the lands were taken back. People could not enter these lands because of fear of landmines, one of the major effects of which was sand and dust storms, as well as when Daesh terrorists controlled a large swathe of Iraqi and Syrian territory. Masoud Tajrishi regretted that also during the US-led invasion of Iraq and Kuwait, when a significant number of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire and smoke rose to miles in air, after studies shown that a significant amount of soot entered our land, settled on the soil, rain washed them into groundwater, fed on plants, animals and humans. He lamented statistics at the Basra Hospital 3 to 4 years after the American occupied Iraq showed that many Iraqi children were born with abnormalities, as well as serious complications and diseases for the residents of the Basra area, all of which were caused by chemical weapons, which the Americans used in huge amounts in Iraqi territory, harming both the Iraqi people and the environment. However, if we are to achieve sustainable development goals, we need to act with greater urgency and coherence to reduce the threats that armed conflict pose to our environment and ultimately pose to our health and livelihood.
Africa Today. Sudan's transitional government signed a peace deal with rebel groups early October to end years of conflict in the country.
However, the deal did not involve some major rebel groups, and people affected by the civil war say they were not consulted and thus the agreement might not hold.
But we've not been properly consulted on the deal that's taking place or represented, and so we're concerned it may not hold.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Shilene Lima.
Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on a fragile peace agreement in Sudan that is now worsened by the country's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
This week, we are also looking into quite positive news coming out of Africa. Yes, we are looking at how Africa's innovators have seen opportunities amid the COVID-19 pandemic and are now solving challenges it imposes, leading to hope rather than despair across the continent.
We also have our weekly collection of interesting news from across Africa.
Sudan peace deal faces challenges. Sudan's transitional government signed a major peace deal with rebel groups early October that's designed to end years of conflict in the country. The agreement signed in the South Sudan capital Juba aims at putting an end to decades of civil war that led to hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions displaced.
Two major rebel groups, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army North and the Sudan Liberation Movement and Army, are not part of the peace deal.
The Sudanese government spokesman acknowledged that major rebel groups boycotted the deal.
We are glad that we managed to achieve a milestone regarding achieving peace in Sudan. We know there are other factions that are yet to sign, and we hope there will be another round to negotiate with these groups.
People on the ground also say they were not consulted and they have expressed doubt if the deal will actually last.
We've been in these camps since 2004. We want the conflict to end so we can go back to our harvests and to our ancestral home. But we've not been properly consulted on the deal that's taking place or represented, and so we're concerned it may not hold.
Now, to discuss further the deal between the Sudanese government and some rebel groups in the country, we have contacted Joseph Ochieno, a writer and African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, Mr. Ochieno, for your time. Now, the Sudan peace agreement was signed in Juba last October. However, major armed groups did not sign the deal. How will this impact on the implementation of these landmark deal?
The parties, particularly the dissenting parties, considering the history of the country, and considering the history particularly of some of the areas that have been substantially marginalized over a long period of time, need not only to be taken seriously, but whatever happens, it would be in the best interest of both parties, and particularly the governing authorities, to make sure that they listen to the opposition, because it's not impossible in Sudan for this agreement to falter should they not necessarily, ensure that they brought together key players together. And key players, when they're armed, you know that in these days you cannot really disregard any armed opposition, whatever their level of strength or influence in the country.
Thanks for that, Joseph Ochieno, African affairs analyst and writer.
Eastern Sudan has recently been rocked by protests, with demonstrators disrupting operations at Port Sudan, the country's largest sea gateway. The protesters were voicing their anger at a lopsided deal between the government and some rebel groups. The irate protesters called for the independence of Eastern Sudan, raising alarm in a country that witnessed the secession of South Sudan less than a decade ago. Why are people in Eastern Sudan objecting to the Juba Agreement, and what are their demands?
There is a sense that the bigger guys, the stronger guys, the guys who are basically meeting round table, are people who are looking for pieces of pie for themselves and their interests rather than the Greater Sudan. So theirs is a legitimate concern, but one of the issues is the resolution of questions of land, which is still a big issue in the Sudan, but also on the other, a settlement of, if you like, transitional justice, considering what has happened since these guys came into power, and including particularly most of the sufferings that the people in that country and in that sub-region faced during the al-Bashir regime. And so, very, very legitimate. Like I said before, they need to be taken seriously. They need to be brought on board. It's a good it's a good step ahead, but they need to be considered, and their grievances need to be brought forward. And if I were amongst the parties, I would do my level best to make sure that they are not left behind.
Sudanese security forces regularly clash with demonstrators protesting against the dire state of the economy and poor living conditions.
The Sudanese people are also protesting the recent move by the transitional government to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
Many Sudanese can't afford basic commodities anymore, and people stand in long queues for fuel and bread. A frustrated Sudanese citizen explains here what he goes through.
Sometimes I wait in the queue for half an hour and sometimes 45 minutes. And in the end, they either say the electricity is out or there is no bread or no more flour to make bread. This is very difficult.
Sudan is also facing protests due to high prices of bread and increased fuel prices. Ms. Olcheno, do these protests present a major threat to the transitional authority in the country?
Well, they do, because the transitional authorities themselves have managed to exploit the protests that led to the overthrow of al-Bashir. And many of these protests were linked, economically linked, obviously politically driven, but mainly around injustices, around how the security services were behaving, high prices of bread, and economic hardships. So it's important that these protests are actually taken seriously. Sudan, actually, amongst many of the many African countries, is one of those that can actually not only prove organized protests, but very deeply and well-driven, intellectually organized and well-articulated protests and organizations. Sudan, amongst very few African countries, that are able to prove that. So they know it.
While the transitional authority in Sudan came to power after a popular revolution that toppled the regime of Omar al-Bashir last year, many Sudanese say their revolution was hijacked by the military. Sudanese people feel the military-led transitional authority is now serving a foreign agenda while ignoring the main objectives of the revolution that ousted al-Bashir.
Now, Mr. Ocheno, some protesters in Sudan have complained of foreign interference in the country. What is the extent of foreign interference in Sudan's internal affairs?
Sudan, like most of our neighbors in this region, and indeed most of Africa, except possibly bits of Southern Africa and these days bits of the extreme west, have been and continue to be, unfortunately, colonies of major external interests, including, of course, the traditional West, Americas of this world, Russia, and indeed, as I say, even Israel. And all this is because of the geopolitics and the resources of the region, whether it is about mineral resources in Congo or its strategic location for Sudan, about its oil and life in Somalia, or perhaps the question about the River Nile and Egypt, and whether or not Egypt is comfortable, and if Egypt is uncomfortable, whether or not Israel is happy.
Well, it appears that Sudan is headed for turbulent times ahead after main rebel groups refused to sign the Juba peace deal.
Things have been made worse by the country's shameful move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. And now in this segment of our program, we are going to present you with interesting news and events from across Africa. How about you, Sheila?
Thank you, Henia. And thank you all for staying with us. Now on to some news. Aquarec, a Kenyan startup, is using an IoT application for fish farming. The app involves using a water sensor that measures temperature, pH, and oxygen levels, which then alerts farmers at least three times a day on the most optimal time to feed the fish. So far, it is being used by 347 farmers. Now, rivals no more. Libya's UN-backed Government of National Accord and the self-styled Libyan National Army signed a permanent ceasefire agreement. The two parties agreed to leave the front line and all foreign fighters to leave Libya within 3 months. Now, in Ethiopia, The Ministry of Women, Children and Youth implemented a mentorship program for adolescent girls. The program called Empowering Girls for a Brighter Tomorrow will help girls acquire knowledge from the experience of Ethiopia's women leaders. It involves daily routine activities to inspire girls to lead. Now, Tanzania launched a $59 million leather factory in the Kilimanjaro region. President Magufuli stated that the facility aims to end importation of leather goods and cultivate the habit of buying locally made goods. The facility will also help expand the market for hides and skins in East Africa. Now, a win for bilateral trade. Rwanda and Angola signed an agreement to grow and promote business investments between the two countries. The opportunities are in the field of manufacturing, transport, mining, and tourism, among others. That's all for now. Do stay tuned for more. Every cloud has a silver lining. This proverbial phrase has clearly manifested itself during the COVID-19 pandemic in Africa.
Before this pandemic, Africa was rarely in the news for inventions in drones, robots, contact tracing apps, non-invasive testing kits, oxygen-making machines, and other high-tech products.
And yet here we are, witnessing an incredible display of possibility. Africa is managing the complexity of the world's most daunting pandemic and looking within for solutions against it.
South Africa is one of the countries which launched several innovative products to combat COVID-19. Early September, the country's health minister, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, announced the launch of a phone app to combat COVID-19.
Today, we are launching a powerful new tool that will help us to contain the coronavirus and prevent a second wave of infections. The Department of Health has developed a mobile app called COVID Alert SA, which uses advanced Bluetooth technology developed by Apple and Google to notify you if you have been exposed to the coronavirus.
For an incisive analysis on this subject, we are joined by Dr. Modrek Chibi, World Health Organization Advisor for Innovation in Africa. Now, we have seen a lot of new innovations in Africa by Africans during the past few months during the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you tell us more about this?
Thank you very much for having me on this show. As the old adage goes, necessity is the mother of invention. Indeed, we have seen emergence of new innovative ways of dealing with the pandemic. And this was necessitated by, I could say, the panic that this pandemic, we are going to address it in the face of weak health systems. So governments didn't have an option other than to come with innovative ways of mitigating the risk of this deadly disease.
Dr. Modrek Chibi, World Health Organization Advisor for Innovation in Africa.
Pre-COVID, Africa imported most of its medication and medical equipment. If recent developments are anything to go by, then great changes are coming across Africa. For instance, in Rwanda, the country's biomedical engineers developed a ventilator following the COVID-19 outbreak, which is the first locally made ventilator in the Central African country. Let's take a listen.
This ventilator is programmed in such a way that it uses natural oxygen to support patients with severe respiratory conditions. That enables the user to adjust the rate of oxygen pushed in the lungs of the patient and adjust the oxygen mix. We have some of the material to develop the ventilators, but the difficult part was to come up with the idea. Coronavirus outbreak sparked the idea. We applied the same machines we used to train our students to come up with this ventilator.
What are some of the outstanding examples of innovation by African countries during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Where we saw drone technology, which was deployed in Rwanda and Ghana, and the drones were deployed for delivering key messages or key vital packages to remote clinics in Rwanda. And in Ghana, we saw that they used drone for pooling of testing to mitigate against shortage of test kits. And the other thing that we also realized is a redeployment of some of the technologies that were deployed for other outbreaks that we have had, for instance, Ebola. We realized that in Liberia, they redeployed their application called MHero, which is a telemedicine tool that they used to train or even to provide information to healthcare workers.
What if we build something that can help people to register themselves and keep track of them, so that shall there be a case of one person turns reactive or confirmed to be having corona, then the group of people he has ever met throughout can be traced as quickly as possible?
Last May, the World Health Organization in the African region hosted the first meeting in a series of virtual sessions for innovators across the region to showcase homegrown creative solutions.
Now, during this session, COVID-19 innovators from Ghana, South Africa, Nigeria, Guinea, and Kenya presented their pioneering solutions.
This Kenyan student here explains about how he developed a swab, which is a brush-like device used to collect the patient's specimen.
The innovative part of this swab is very flexible, as you can see. So it has been engineered to be flexible, meaning that once it gets to your nasopharyngeal path, it's not going to cause you pain, as it will move well to the place where it's supposed to get the swab.
Now, Dr. Achebe, what needs to be done to continue supporting innovators and maintain the current momentum of homegrown solutions for medical needs in Africa?
As you know, innovation is the ultimate game changer. We are advocating for countries to invest in new infrastructure. And for innovation to flourish, some underlying technological platform needs to be in place. Things like internet, robotics. We have realized that if the is lack of underlying technological platform, even if our homegrown innovators have got brilliant minds, sometimes they are incapacitated simply because of lack of underlying technological platform that necessitate their innovation development process. We are also advocating for governments to come up with incentive framework or even policy framework that makes it easier or facilitate development, scaling, and monitoring impact of those innovations.
Many African leaders are chairing national COVID-19 task forces of public health to guide the pandemic response. This has created an opportunity for innovations to be recognized publicly and thus boost the morale of innovators.
We are grateful that we have seen innovation out of this crisis. For example, students at Kenyatta University need to be applauded for developing a prototype of an inexpensive ventilator for use in our local hospitals. Not to be left behind, other universities and technical institutions are also making remarkable progress.
Dr. Chibi, you talked about mainstreaming innovations. Do you think African governments have given science the seriousness it deserves, especially in terms of budgetary allocations?
When we are talking of budget allocation in countries, yes, it's important. But when you provide the space for innovation to flourish, you may not necessarily need to provide hard cash on it. Provide incentive mechanism, provide that policy framework, come up with some de-risking mechanism, you know, to support scaling, and all these elements that comprises what we call innovation ecosystem. When they are in place, I tell you, government may not necessarily need to put their cash on the table so that they can facilitate development of innovation. Because I've interacted with key stakeholders, innovators, innovation funders, private sector. The bottleneck has always been the government support.
Dr. Chibi, you mentioned there about your interaction with the private sector. Now, in your opinion, what is the role of the private sector in Africa in boosting innovation?
Private sector is such a tremendous and important role to play in the innovation ecosystem. Just looking at it from a value chain perspective, if the private sector can support innovation efforts on the continent by leveraging their expertise, their capabilities, you realize that there will be of value add to the innovation efforts on the continent. What am I trying to say? We know that private sector have established functional manufacturing platform. They have got such a network, distribution network, or value chain networks. They are good at communication. They are good at marketing. And they can also provide support on business development to our innovators.
Now, from our discussion with Dr. Chibi today, it's quite obvious that a lot more can come out of Africa in terms of innovative technologies and solutions.
What African innovators need is support from their government and the private sector.
Now it is time for us to hear what you had for us this week. In recent weeks, the state in Nigeria has been sensitive, of course, owing to police brutality that has affected more so the youth. Omar Ababusman shared two images and stated, "If you think this man looted the warehouse because he was a hoodlum or because he takes pleasure in violence, something is wrong with your head. Perhaps he has not come in contact with a bag of rice for years. His life might have been just hand to mouth, Nigeria." We also had PACA shared an image titled "Pan-African Activists Condemn U.S. Training of Nigerian Police." We also had Amatone stating, "Make a report about NSAS Now protests in Nigeria. Let our voices be heard." And that we will do. Surely next week we have a whole episode program on Nigeria. Don't miss it.
Well, on that positive note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today, which focused on a fragile peace deal between the Sudanese government and some of the country's rebel groups.
We also highlighted on encouraging technological innovations in Africa amid the COVID-19 pandemic. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. Stay safe and goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.